Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games and now introducing live blackjack, roulette, and casino hold'em. These are so much fun. Modo always has generous jackpots, free spins, and exciting promotions. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US.
Continuing my conversation with Professor Sean McMeekin, his new book, To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. Karl Marx is a Prussian, a European. Vladimir Lenin is a Russian, a European. Mao Zedong is neither. He is a man who comes from the peasant, pigtail-wearing Chinese, born in 1893, so much younger than the older revolutionary communists that we've been watching in Europe. However, he is radicalized as a student, especially something called the May 4th of 1919, I believe, in reaction to what was considered to be a sellout of China at the Versailles Treaty. That is not his Marxism, however. He comes to Marxist-Leninism later on, reading the Communist Manifesto, reading what he can of Marx. However, Professor, again, congratulations for this. In reading the Europeans and their struggle with Marx when he was obtuse and when he was rhetorical, Marx is a great writer. He would have been successful in Hollywood for making up titles and easy ways to explain motion pictures. However, I'm struck by the fact that Mao Zedong and his followers were not Marxists. What were they? How did they regard Marx's writings that was supposed to be the genesis of their revolution?
Well, I think the key to understanding some of the differences of Marxism and later communism in Asia is that in some ways it's agglomerative. You're taking some of what you had in Europe already, ideas about this kind of binary struggle between oppressor and oppressed, but it's blended together with this very sharp anti-imperialism, because of course this is a country which is not in Europe, a country which had been prey to a lot of exploitation, I mean, let's be honest, by the European powers going back to the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion. So that Mao's not the only one. Of course, you have Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang, who also have this kind of, even though they would later embrace a lot of foreign aid and foreign help, in the same way Mao, of course, would accept help from Soviet Russia, they still have this political rhetoric about trying to overturn or overthrow or liberate the country from foreign influence and foreign rule. So there's a real xenophobic element, I think, to Chinese communism. And I think this explains a lot of both the particular radicalism or the directions that it took in China. So that you can see that in everything from the kind of anti-American campaign during the Korean War to, you might say, kind of the heights of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, with this almost phantasmagorical xenophobia and targeting of foreigners and foreign influences and foreign fashions and foreign music and all kinds of foreign elements. So that here, you don't just have the idea of capitalist oppressors and oppressed, maybe a more strictly Marxist vision. Rather, the idea is that the kind of the Chinese masses, the peasants, the poor of China are oppressed by this global imperialistic system, so that you want to eradicate and wipe out all elements of that in China. And some of this was actually eased along by the fact that, of course, as Mao and the Red Army were conquering China, so many of the foreigners, along with, of course, a lot of Chinese merchants and business owners and traders and intellectuals, actually did flee. And so there was this element then of not just a class war, but this phrase, hesperophobia, I've always thought was quite useful, the idea of almost a fear and loathing of the West. Partly an inferiority complex, part of it was, I think, a genuine resentment, a ressentiment in the French phrase, and part of it was, I think, just this visceral glowing hatred. And it really wasn't, unfortunately, that hard to mobilize people behind this vision. Again, a kind of a mixture of the same type of class envy that you might have felt, you know, in a more traditional kind of a Marxist framework, along with this vicious kind of xenophobia.
I note you're reporting that Mao was reading before Marx, Adam Smith, Rousseau, Darwin, and Huxley. What a strange group. except for the fact that that's educated reading, and yet he took the revolutionary bend that you can get out of Leninism, not Marxist, but the Leninism part. So was it the violence that attracted him? Can we tell now?
I think the violence was definitely a huge part of the appeal. I mean, Mao's personality was definitely more eccentric, and I think, as you're pointing out, his reading was a little bit more eccentric and perhaps inconsistent as well. It's not that he wasn't dogmatic, it's just that his varieties of dogma were a little bit stranger and more eccentric, and his personality was also kind of larger and louder in a lot of ways. A lot of people have compared some of the grandiose spectacles that you would see in Maoist China, everything from these colossal book burnings to Mao's public swimming feats that would be kind of trumpeted to the media. There was an element almost of a kind of a Hitlerian or Mussolini-style fascism or Nazism just in the public display of it, and of course in the personality cult. But a lot of it was, I think, more directly inspired. Certainly when you had these figures like Chen Boda, who was present in the 30s during the Stalin purges, and they come back and they conduct certain purges, I think you have to say that Mao was kind of ecumenical in borrowing various elements from the different strains of political thought, the different strains of tyrannical political traditions in Europe, and trying them all out and kind of just seeing what would stick. But I think in the end, yes, if there was a central glue, it was some variety of this kind of inferiority complex, the class envy, and also, I think, the xenophobia, I think, that really explains a lot of what was particular and peculiar about the Chinese communist tradition under Mao.
The extreme violence of the Second War leads to the ability of the Chinese communists, who have been driven into the provinces by fate and the Japanese. And there's the challenge of the Chiang Kai-shek Nationalist Army. The extreme violence brings them back into power, and the Red Army sweeps over the country, and the People's Republic of China is founded in the late 1940s. I want to go to how Mao used this power to stay in power, because he's aware of how Stalin runs his organization. Stalin treats him very badly when Mao is beckoned to Moscow at one point and kept cooling his heels for weeks, while Stalin deliberately doesn't send to him. It's meant to be humiliating. The Soviets were always condescending towards everyone around them, but especially the Chinese. However, once Stalin is gone, 1953, and the triumvirate, eventually just Khrushchev, take controls, Mao is on his own to experiment. And now we have the Great Leap Forward, which leads to a vast famine. Millions dead, unknown millions. And Mao blames anybody but himself, blames his own Politburo. And where is the thinking in this, Professor? Because it looked very much like Mao just experimenting with some ideas, but I don't know where he got them from. To starve people to death is communism?
Well, he seems to have gotten them from the Stalin period of collectivization in the early 1930s. I mean, if you believe Khrushchev, for example, who actually rebuked Mao for this and basically said, there's no reason for you to be repeating our own stupid mistakes. If you talk about where they come from, though, I think in both cases, again, there were peculiar elements that were maybe a little bit different or unique to either Russia and Ukraine or to China. But the phrase is actually there, believe it or not, right in the manifesto of the Communist Party, the idea of industrial armies in the countryside. It's an evocative but also a rather vague and suggestive phrase. What does it mean exactly? You're trying to catch up and surpass the West. And here's where the language is quite similar. When Stalin was launching not just the collectivization drive but also the first five-year plan, usually conventionally dated to about 1928, although one of them was backdated a little bit later, he's talking about the need to catch up with and surpass the West, the idea that they have to almost telescope Russia's industrial development for 50 years maybe into just 5 or 10 years. So you get these plans. So the idea is we're behind. We have to catch up and surpass the capitalist world. Mao was saying the same things in the late 50s. Oddly enough, Khrushchev was talking in similar ways about economic production, about things like milk and meat and even corn production. That is, that the Soviets, because of their superior planning, would actually overtake the West. And a large part of the Cold War competition really was, believe it or not, in this realm of perceived economic productivity that the Soviets would outproduce the West. Mao said, well, we don't think we can catch up quite as quickly with the United States, but we will surpass Britain. So believe it or not, it's a combination of a phrase from the Manifesto of the Communist Party, the Stalinist example from collectivization, the first five-year plan, and then also this kind of almost yin and yang with Khrushchev promising to surpass the United States, and Mao wants to surpass Britain. This means somehow, in Mao's somewhat warped, xenophobic Marxist imagination, that means you have to radically overturn Chinese traditional agriculture and simultaneously industrialize and also collectivize agriculture involving hundreds of millions of peasants, which of course does not go well. I mean, everything from the famous backyard smelting furnaces for people's proverbial utensils that they were supposed to smelt in the backyard. I'm not sure what purpose that was supposed to serve, but it also meant that they no longer had the ability to eat at home, and so they would have to go into the communal mess halls, and so everyone would be kind of communized in really in every possible direction. It leads to, of course, chaos and famine. At least tens of millions, again, probably the best recent estimates, you're talking about 40 to 45 million people die in the Great Leap Forward. So what it came from a blend, a very strange and bizarre melange of ideas drawing from Marx and from Stalin, and even a little bit of competition, I think, with Khrushchev.
Professor Sean McMakin, To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. When we come back, The Red Guard. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Let's check in with golf legend John Daly.
I only spend on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. That's Daly. Moto Casino, hands down, has the best VIP experience. Take it from one high roller to another. Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces. If you're ready to go for the greens with me, grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details.